right. It appears as though we do not have counsel for a respondent present. It, you know, has some effect on today's proceedings. As counsel for appellant just noted, there is was a request for a continuance in the record that was denied. In any event, counsel for appellant, here's what we're going to do. I'll have the marshal, now that she's returned to her desk, call the third case on our oral argument calendar. I'll make a few remarks and then we will hear from you. So, marshal, please call the third case.
Calling A230965, Dimble Ali petitioner, appellant versus Faria Muhammad respondent.
All right, and counsel, what I'm going to do is just make a couple of quick remarks. So first of all, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We look forward to hearing your argument today. Of course, the matter was fully briefed and has been, the judges are familiar with the record in the case. You can, when you're ready, you could even do it while I'm talking, go ahead and take a spot at the podium. You'll notice that the podium is adjustable, and I just point that out to you to make encourage you to make yourself comfortable with your materials, with the height of the podium. You'll see there are lights on the podium, timing. Please keep an eye on the clock on the podium. It will let you know when your time is about to expire, so that's helpful. And then before you start your remarks, if you would identify yourself as well as the client that you represent, that helps us keep a clear audio recording. The audio recording is later made available on the court's website. So with that, counsel for appellant, we're ready to hear from you. You have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Matt Gilbert. I represent the appellant, Dimble Ali. The parties, it's undisputed, the parties are first cousins. Marriage between first cousins is absolutely void in Minnesota pursuant to Minnesota Statute 517.03. 518.01 further provides that when there's a marriage that's absolutely void, there is no marriage and there's no need for a dissolution or other legal proceeding because the marriage never existed in the first place. Despite the clear dictates of these statutes, the trial court in this matter found that the party's marriage is valid. There are no statutory exceptions to marriages between first cousins. The closest to an exception is under 517.03.1b, which relates to an exception of persons under age 18 marrying out of state. And it does not include if those persons were if they were residents of the state. And again, this does not apply to first cousins like we have here. Given the clear dictates of the statute, we request the court convert this proceeding to a custody proceeding under Anderson.
Counsel, what facts make the respondent a Minnesota resident? What contacts?
Your Honor, I'm not even sure if she needs to be a Minnesota resident, as we argue in our brief. The appellant clearly was a Minnesota resident.
Well, she was here on a three-month visa at that point, is that correct?
She was, Your Honor.
Okay, and how long was she? She was here 3 days?
So she was here 3 days, but she never went back to the United Kingdom. From the record, it was clear she intended to live in Minnesota, where she has lived since coming to Minnesota. And there's case law that we cited looking at the domicile of a party, and clearly she was domiciled in Minnesota from the facts in the record.
So, counsel, if I understand you right and the record right, I might not, so help me out.
Sure.
She became domiciled in Minnesota after the marriage, right?
But before the marriage.
Okay, so what's the record evidence of that, that she was domiciled in Minnesota before the marriage?
She came to Minnesota. There was a ceremonial marriage ceremony in Minnesota approximately a few days after.
3 days?
During those 3 days, and the parties subsequently flew to Hawaii. They were there for approximately a week, were married in Hawaii, and then flew back to Minnesota, where they've lived ever since.
Well, the legal ceremony took place in Hawaii then, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And we did cite Lakola, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court case, which provides this court should give full deference to out-of-state marriages, to the legality of those marriages, except when they violate a public policy. And Lakola specifically cites a strong public policy as set forth in 517.03 .03, which is marriage between first cousins.
In the Bogan and Ma are two appellate cases arising from dissolutions where there was a marriage out of state that would have been void or invalid in Minnesota, but it was upheld by the Minnesota court, right?
That's correct. In those cases, there's not the strong public policy under 517.03. For example, in Ma, the issue is whether the cultural marriage would be contrary to a strong public policy. And that's simply not a basis to declare a marriage void under 517.03.
But in the Bogan case, which had to do with marrying too soon after a prior divorce, I mean that was prohibited in Minnesota, right?
It's not absolutely void under 517.03. I think there's three different criteria for an absolutely void marriage under 517.03. And one of those criteria is marriage between first cousins. And again, Licola specifically cites to that statute as a basis showing that that's strongly against public policy. The other issue raised in our brief is with regard to legal custody. The trial court appointed a custody evaluator through Hennepin County who did a very detailed custody analysis. As a part of the analysis, he found that the parties should share joint legal custody. Minnesota Statute 517 Subdivision 1B9 requires the trial court, when looking at legal custody, to analyze various factors, especially if there's an allegation of domestic abuse. That includes the nature and context of the domestic abuse and the implications of the domestic abuse for parenting and for the child's safety, well-being, and developmental needs. There was no analysis of these factors by the trial court. The custody evaluator went in-depth analysis of these factors and the implications of the parties really working together and co-parenting, and again concluded the parties should share joint legal custody. There's simply just no analysis from the trial court on these factors or really addressing the analysis of Mr. Hyland, the custody evaluator.
So help me out, counsel, because to overturn, if I understand correctly, overturn the legal custody decision of the district court, we have to find an abuse of discretion, right?
That's correct, okay, or so a misapplication of the law.
Okay, so give me that argument, if you would.
In your honor, there's case law that we've cited stating when there is a neutral custody evaluation, the court has to make specific findings if the order is going to be contrary to the custody evaluator's recommendation and findings. And again, I mean, this is the statute. It's clear as day. These are the factors the trial court is required to consider with regard to a legal custody decision. And those factors were just never considered by the trial court.
So, counsel, I guess I see a difference between whether the analysis is written out as opposed to the information submitted to the court and the court considers it. Now, there's no indication the district court didn't consider the neutral evaluator's opinion. Is there? Am I missing something?
The record is sparse. I mean, there's no real, Mr. Hyland's report isn't really acknowledged in any of the court's decisions. The court doesn't acknowledge the findings of Mr. Hyland through Hennepin County. And again, the court does have the authority to reach a contrary decision from the custody evaluator. But again, this is one of the most important pieces to my client is legal custody and his ability to make these major decisions on behalf of his child. The district court did order the parties to share 50-50 parenting time. And frankly, it seems a little obtuse to have a 50-50 schedule, but have no say whatsoever in any of the major education, religion, healthcare decisions on behalf of your child, especially when the custody evaluator made very detailed findings saying this allegation of domestic abuse was a one-time incident. The respondent had conceded that this had never happened before and that he, in his 8-page analysis, felt the parties could work together and make these major decisions themselves. Again, we're just asking the court to apply the law for the court to make these specific findings and to actually address this neutral custody evaluation. The next issue raised in our brief relates to the imputation of $20,000 in income to appellant. My client had operated a couple different businesses that shuttered. With that, his income had dramatically decreased. The businesses are no longer in operation. At trial, he submitted pay stubs showing he's earning $13 per hour. The court cited to a finding 43 in the decree, stating that he earned $1.2 million in 2018. The record does not reflect that. In 2018, he produced a tax return that was admitted into evidence, showing he only earned business profit of $104,791. And that's Trial Exhibit 15B in the judgment and decree. There's been no other factual finding to remotely support an imputation of $20,000 in income to appellant. 518A.32 is clear that the court could impute income consistent with the prevailing opportunities in the community and potential employment. It does not allow a court to speculate if or force a party to operate a business, especially if a business is no longer in operation.
Mr. Gilbert, it appears the district court, when using the number 1.2 million, was referring to the revenue derived by two companies. And I think your argument is that the district court was improperly focused on revenue and not on net profit. I'm not sure where, even if we look at revenue, I'm not sure where the 1.2 comes from. Can you help me on that? I think there's one company's tax returns in the record which shows revenue of $800,000 and some, but I'm not sure about the difference.
And Your Honor, that's a great question. There's nothing in the record to support that number, that 1.2. He only had one company in 2018. In 2019, he did have two companies. So that tax return may better support, I think, whatever the court is alleging in that finding. But still, revenue is much different than net business income. And there's a statute, 518A.30, which discusses calculating income for the self-employed individuals. And there's bona fide business expenses that he had. He never actually earned net income of $1.2 million as found in that factual finding. A big part of this case, too, is appellant, he did not know he needed to pay payroll taxes, which is one of the big reasons for why both of his businesses really went under. And it was no longer profitable for him to operate those businesses because of the huge tax liabilities that he incurred, and ultimately he was awarded as a part of the divorce.
Somewhat related to that is, but maybe different, the third issue in your brief challenges the district court's decision to exclude evidence of certain tax returns, such as Exhibits 35 and 36 were his personal tax returns. I have a few questions about that, and that is, in the orders that are in the addendum, I do not see an order compelling discovery of the 2021 tax returns. In other words, at the time of the earlier order compelling discovery in, I think it was December 21, the years that were compelled were 19, 18, and 17, I believe. Were there subsequent, I'm just asking now as a matter of procedural history, subsequent orders that ordered the production of subsequent years' tax returns?
There was an order entered, I believe, in January of 20. And this case has dragged on for longer than the marriage, but there was an order entered, I believe, January of 2022, ordering the production of a series of documents within, I believe, it was about 7 days. And then there's a subsequent order entered in June of that same year, finding that appellant had not complied with that order and that the court was making adverse inferences against him.
And was there an order, not now I'm thinking about the 21 tax returns, that they were produced, I think, in March of 22, right?
That sounds correct, Your Honor.
Was there an order to produce them earlier before the tax filing deadline?
Yes, there was.
Okay, and then you're not challenging that order then?
Well, we're challenged. Well, the orders kind of flow through with each other because there's that January order followed by that May or June order of that same year. And again, that January order required appellant to produce a tax return in January for the preceding year. And as a business owner, a lot of information, 1099s, K1s, they're just not available. And the deadline for filing taxes, a lot of business owners, they get a continuance or they wait till October before filing.
I understand the logic of that,
sure.
So but I guess I'm wondering, are you saying that the underlying order to compel, order to produce is erroneous for that reason?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay.
And it's just wholly unreasonable. There's no way he could have produced a tax return, even if his whole life was dedicated to it, in that time frame.
And then one more question about these tax returns, which were excluded. I'm wondering what relevance they have if we assume as correct the district court made findings that your client, I think, intentionally closed down or transferred away his two businesses, and that I think the gist of it is that he was attempting to reduce his income by getting rid of his businesses. District court found his testimony on that issue not credible. In light of that, does it really matter whether his personal individual tax returns from 20 and 21 are in the record?
Your Honor, I mean, to be frank, I'm not sure if it really matters, but to the extent the court is trying to impute income to appellant, I think those tax returns speak volumes regarding the income he is not receiving. Again, those tax returns, which he spent considerable money having a tax preparer solely for this court proceeding, and there's a number of other documents too, but those tax returns show that he's not earning money through these business entities.
Well, they show only employment income, I believe, but that's relevant to the district court's point that he previously earned income through the profits of a small business, but then he intentionally disposed of those companies, so to speak. And so, I mean, in other words, the district judge was making a finding of what his income would be or would have been if he still was operating those businesses, essentially. So I'm just wondering whether the individual tax returns, which, show only employment income, are really relevant to the analysis.
And Your Honor, it looks like I'm out of time, but to answer your question quickly, under 518.32, it doesn't look at what he could potentially earn operating a business. That's totally outside the scope of the statute as far as imputing income to an obligor. So to the extent, to answer your question, yes, that's correct. I mean, really, it's irrelevant how much he was earning or not earning at the time, but it just seems disingenuous to say, I don't know what his income is, but I'm not going to accept these tax returns showing what his income is, while at the same time accepting his pay stubs into evidence.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions from the panel? Okay, and counsel, if you'd like to take a moment to sum up, feel free to go ahead and do that.
In Your Honors, it's clear from the record. The statute's clear regarding marriage between first cousins in Minnesota. There's very good reason for that, including potential health defects involving children. The parties do have a child, unfortunately, who does have some special needs. We do ask that the court just apply the law across the board with regard to these issues. One issue I didn't get to briefly talk about it is we did raise this issue regarding the void marriage. The court dismissed our motion to have the whole marriage vacated and converted to a custody proceeding. The district court or the trial court then assessed my client with $5,000 in conduct-based attorney's fees. The judgment and decree which was filed approximately a year later, provides in finding of fact 87 and 88 that my client did not, in fact, unnecessarily contribute to the length and extent of the proceeding, which is the standard that's applied in awarding conduct-based attorney's fees. Again, this motion was filed in good faith. Even the court's own findings state, contrary to the prior court's order, that he did not unnecessarily contribute to the length and extent of the proceeding. So we do ask that that judgment be vacated. And with that, I have nothing further unless your honors have questions.
We very much appreciate hearing from you today. It always helps the court to have the oral arguments. With that, this matter is submitted to the court for a decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.
So that concludes our oral argument calendar today. The court will be in recess for its non-oral calendar. We're going to actually take a brief break and then return to the courtroom. We have some visitors today. We appreciate seeing that. And we will have a short conversation. So with that, we are in recess. Thank you.
All rise.